WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dick Gephardt, has been the Democratic leader of the U.S. House of Representatives since 1994. He's hoping to become the House Speaker after the next election. The Democrats would have to gain six more seats for that to happen. Gephardt had been considering a run in the presidential primary, but he decided to stay in Congress after the Democrats picked up House seats in the 98 election, making it conceivable that they could be the majority party after the next election. Gephardt ran in the 1988 presidential primary and withdrew. Gephardt represents his hometown of St. Louis, Missouri. He's written a new book called An Even Better Place, America in the 21st Century. I asked him if he thinks we're heading towards sending ground troops to Kosovo.
Well, I think it's impossible to know the answer to that question now. I do think that the air campaign is showing results. I believe that the president's policy and NATO's policy has been the right policy. I don't think it would have been proper for us to just stand by and see this ethnic cleansing and virtual genocide go on. Having said that, at some point here in the next weeks, how many weeks, I don't know, a decision will have to be made on whether or not we can get a settlement with Mr. Milosevic and the Serbs that more or less reaches NATO's goals without putting more people on the ground. As you know, the winter is coming, and there's a time window here for even being able to get people on the ground in this year. So a tough decision has to be made, and it can't be made until A, NATO decides it together, and then B, the feasibility of that plan, the logistics of that plan are presented to NATO and the Congress.
In your new book, you write a little bit about the Gulf War, and you say that you think it was very important that Congress debated the war before it began. You say, I hate to think of the second-guessing that would have resulted had the president launched an invasion without the consent of the Congress, particularly if the war that followed had proven to be lengthy or unsuccessful. Do you think Congress should have debated before the bombing of Serbia?
Well, in effect, we did. there was a resolution in the House supporting the troops and what was happening. I believe it was before or right at the time the bombing started. So I think we had that debate, and we certainly had it after it had started when we had a full debate of a whole series of questions and votes. So I think the right thing was done, and before a ground war starts, I hope that we have a debate in the Congress and think we will and think we should. It should be noted that George Bush put 500,000, roughly 500,000 American troops on the ground before we had a vote. We voted just before the ground war started, but not before the troops were on the ground.
Is this a particularly eventful period for congressmen such as yourself to go right from impeachment to war?
Well, it is. You know, I've said many times the most important votes we make in the Congress are probably first war and then impeachment. And we've seen both here in a matter of months together. So it has been a very active time in the Congress. And it's a shame that these kinds of events, although they're obviously happening in front of us, take us away from dealing with a whole range of other issues that I try to talk about in my book, An Even Better Place, that I think are our most important challenges. But that's the nature of life today and something we've got to go through. But I do hope that sooner rather than later, we can get back to the really important challenges that face us as a people, such as education and child care and child raising and how we run institutions.
Your new book opens with the impeachment, and you describe how you were preparing to give a speech to the House when the new speaker, Bob Livingston, resigned, and you had to tear up your old speech and write a new one immediately. Tell us what went through your mind then when you realized you had to address this matter immediately and had to come up with something that would be appropriate to say, that you could live with, and that would be meaningful.
Well, it was a troubling day, to be sure. First of all, the president was being impeached, and we were denied a vote on what we thought was the proper alternative, which was censure. And so our side and a lot of our members were deeply offended at the procedure and the lack of an alternative on the floor. And it was really that question that I was preparing to address for the second day in a row. I had prepared that speech the night before and was working on it that day when my press secretary came in the room and said, there's a rumor in the press office of the House that the then-to-be Speaker Bob Livingston was going to resign because of revelations in Hustler magazine. I was stunned. I was absolutely knocked out by it and couldn't believe it. I said to her, oh, that can't be true. That's just a silly rumor. And the next minute, watching him on television, I saw him resign. And so I was really moved by it and really troubled, because I really believe that we are in what I called in my speech the politics of destruction. And I think that when you see a president being impeached, a speaker who hasn't even been elected being driven from office by revelations in a magazine that doesn't have a lot of repute in the country, you really begin to wonder what's happening in your country. Bob Livingston's a good person. He's performed valuable public service. I don't agree with him on a lot of issues, but I have tremendous respect for him and the service he's brought to the country. And it was a moving day. So I sat down and rewrote the speech and tried to say something that conveyed my emotional concern about what was happening in our country. My hope first that Livingston would stay on and wouldn't resign in the face of these charges. And secondly, that all of us could do better in impeachment and thereafter to bring a new sense of idealism and respect and trust to our political life, which I really think we have to do.
Let me quote some of your speech. You said, our founding fathers created a system of government of men, not of angels. No one standing in this House today can pass a puritanical test of purity that some are demanding that our elected leaders take. We need to stop destroying imperfect people at the altar of an unattainable morality. I thought you were implying there that many of the congressmen wouldn't measure up to the standards they were holding others to. And I'm wondering if that's what you meant to say, and if so, was that a guess on your part, or was it pretty common knowledge about a lot of people not upholding the standards they were measuring others by?
No, I don't know that, and obviously I don't think we ought to spend all of our time trying to investigate one another to find out everything there is to know. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have ethics. I'm not saying we shouldn't have ethics investigations if they're warranted. But when the members themselves are launching the ethics investigations and we're pawing through everybody's background to see if there just might be something that would not be so proud, then we've really lost our focus, lost our common sense, and we've turned this into what I call the politics of destruction, which I think will ruin the whole system of self-governance.
If you're just joining us, my guest is House Democratic Leader Dick Gephardt. He's written a new book called An Even Better Place, America in the 21st Century. You say that the politics of personal destruction is discouraging citizens from running for office or accepting government appointments. Were you thinking about the politics of personal destruction when you decided not to run for the presidency?
No. That decision was really made on the ground that I felt an obligation and a priority in trying to win the House back. I feel the analogy I've been using is that I kind of feel like a quarterback of a football team or a coach who is, with the team's great effort, been able to get down to the one-yard line. When you're at the one-yard line, you don't leave the stadium to go to the next stadium and play a different game. And so that's what I thought leaving to run for president would be. And so the election in 98, when we again picked up seats after the historic loss of the Congress in 1994, really convinced me that my job at this time should be to stay in the House and try to win a majority back.
The Democrats are six seats away from gaining control of the House. What's your strategy to try to win the House?
Well, it's not anything that everyone wouldn't understand. First, you have to get good candidates who are competitive and make a good impression in the public. That's the most important thing. Second, you have to help them fund their campaigns, which I work at a fair amount. And then thirdly, you have to help them run competent, effective campaigns. Money alone does not mean election. You've got to husband and use the resources effectively, and you have to run an effective message and mechanical campaign.
How, if at all, would you like to see the impeachment process enter into the issues in the upcoming election? I mean, during the impeachment, everybody was saying, well, is this going to backfire against the Republicans, and will they end up losing votes as a result of the way they handle the impeachment, or will it hurt the Democrats because it was a Democratic president that went through the impeachment process? So do you think this is going to affect the next election?
Oh, I think in a perhaps a marginal way. I think people...
Are you going to try to play it up in any way?
No, I don't think it's an issue anymore. I think people will not be wanting to hear about impeachment. That's yesterday's news. I think what will be looked at is how the Republican leadership performed during impeachment. Did they do a good job? Did they carry out commonsensical, reasonable leadership? And on that, I think some people will conclude and believe they didn't do a good job, and they carried it out too long, they drug it out, and they did not allow proper alternatives on the floor. I think some voters will look at that. It's kind of part of a larger picture of whether people think the Republicans have had good stewardship in the way they've run the House, the kind of agenda they've brought, and how they've chosen to spend their time on the House floor.
My guest is Dick Gephardt, the House Democratic leader. He's written a new book called An Even Better Place, America in the 21st Century. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is House Democratic leader Dick Gephardt. He's written a new book called An Even Better Place, America in the 21st Century. In your book, you write a little bit about how the climate in Congress compares to when you arrived in 1976. And you say now Democrats and Republicans don't even make eye contact when they pass one another in the halls of Congress unless it's to exchange furious glares. Tell me more how you think the climate in Congress compares now to when you first arrived.
Well, it was a very different time. First of all, we didn't have television in the House on the floor, so the debates that went on were really internal debates and not really seen by the public on television. The reporters were present, but that's a very different medium, is obviously, than television. So there was less bombastic and tough debate on the floor. I think, secondly, members got along better, and even though we disagreed on issues, there were better personal relationships. People spent more time on the floor. They got to know one another better. They learned about each other's families. They had a better personal relationship. As time has gone on, the floor has gotten more frantic. Members don't spend much time there. They're running to other meetings on the Hill or meetings with constituents. And then you have the entry of what I call the politics of destruction, which is actual members filing ethics charges against one another, making personal attacks against one another, to the point where there's real hard feelings between members and a lack of cooperation, a lack of collaboration between the two sides, which was present when I first became a member of the House.
Well, let me pick up on the ethics issue that you just raised. And you mentioned this in the book, what you describe as a kind of tit-for-tat process of filing ethics complaints, something very close to blackmail. You say that in 1995, Newt Gingrich, who was then the Speaker, told you that if you didn't get the Democrats to stop the attacks against him, that he'd retaliate by filing an ethics complaint against you about undeclared income from a vacation property. Tell us more about that threat.
Well, it was delivered primarily through staff, but it was very clearly delivered, and then it happened. And so it was what I call the cycle of destruction that goes on and went on, and hopefully we've now brought to a close. It is, to me, something that's very hard to stop, because once it starts, we're all human, and people like to get revenge and retribution, and that's what I think was going on there. And when that breaks out, it's very hard to bring it to a close. It's also very hard to contain it, because it very quickly gets to the point where everybody has ethics charges filed against them, and we do nothing but ethics charges.
How did you handle it when, you know, Newt Gingrich's people threatened that they would retaliate against you with an ethics charge?
Well, I dealt with the ethics charge in the process in the ethics committee, which took a good deal of time. And I tried to get our members to not retaliate. There were actually ethics charges filed against other members of our leadership. And they dealt with it in their own time. And I tried to not have retaliation and not to keep this going. And when it was all finished, when Newt's ethics charges were finished and mine were finished and others were finished, I tried consciously to stop retaliation and to stop any further activity, and we've had a fairly good experience at that since then.
Now, the charges against you, I believe, were dismissed, although the committee said that you should pay more attention to filing the appropriate papers for profits earned on this property.
Right. And it was a lack of filing, as I remember, one fact which had no relevance to anything, and was inadvertence by my attorneys and myself. But there was not an ethics problem, and the whole thing was dismissed, as it was with the other Democratic members who had charges filed against them.
How have you seen different House speakers during your years in Congress set the tone for better or worse in terms of the treatment of fellow congressmen?
Well, I think each one of them probably tries to do it in different ways. One of the things that I think Newt Gingrich believed that I don't believe, but I'm sure he believed it strongly, was that Congress is almost like a parliamentary system. By that I mean, I think he felt that he should get all the votes on every issue on the Republican side alone, his side alone, and that collaboration with Democrats was really not going to bear any fruit or not going to happen because of the very hot competition that we are in politically to control the House. That meant there was kind of a signal sent from the Speaker that you don't collaborate with Republicans, you don't work with them, you don't reach agreements on tough issues because there may be some political impact on their side. And once you start that, then the other side adopts that position as well, and it's very hard to get back to a more consensual situation. Part of this is caused by the hot competition. The country is very closely competed for. When you ask voters, are they Republicans or Democrats, it's very even today. So that's part of it. When I came to the Congress, people like Tip O'Neill enjoyed very large majorities, so maybe it wasn't a comparable situation. But there was a lot of collaboration on the committees. Republicans and Democrats worked together. It was not a parliamentary situation. There were bipartisan majorities for most bills. There was very little solid party voting on anything. That's really changed. Again, part of it is the close political competition for the House, but part of it is this idea that we're a parliament and that the majority party should have everybody vote together all the time.
My guest is House Democratic Leader Dick Gephardt. He's written a new book called An Even Better Place, America in the 21st Century. You said that you'd like to see the House vote on a gun control bill before Memorial Day. What do you think the odds of that are?
I don't think good. As you know, the majority sets the schedule, and I don't think they want to vote on it now. I think they want to vote on it in June, and that's their prerogative. I think that given that we have a bipartisan agreement in the House on a juvenile justice bill, which is the underlying bill and a very important bill, and in that the Senate has already spoken on these, frankly, moderate and modest gun safety measures, that we ought to go ahead and do it. I think the nation is wanting us to act. I think the parents of these of the children everywhere who are worried about their children want action out of the Congress and state legislatures. And I think we ought to go ahead and act before we leave, and that's what we're going to try to get the majority to do.
Dick Gephardt, he's written a new book called An Even Better Place, America in the 21st Century. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Dick Gephardt, the Democratic leader of the U.S. House of Representatives. He's written a new book called An Even Better Place, America in the 21st Century. You know, we're talking about how the politics of destruction is discouraging people from entering politics. And I think for some people, there's something else also, something far more trivial that discourages them from entering into politics. And I'm thinking of the haircuts. In fact, I want to read you this quote. This is from University of Virginia political scientist Larry Sabato. This is a quote from the Washington Post. And this was right after your speech about Livingston when he was going to resign. And Sabato really liked your speech very much. And he said about you, he looks, sounds, and acts so much like the prototypical modern politician, a combination of news anchor and game show host, that he really caught me by surprise. He had his heart in his speech, and it showed. But that there's something true in there about a lot of politicians having that look of the news anchor and game show host and a certain kind of regulation, political haircut. And I'm wondering if you feel that there are pressures to look a certain way in order to win and then perform in office.
Well, I can't help the way I look.
Well, you could change haircuts. I'm not saying you need to change haircuts. But, I mean, there is that kind of look of the certain haircut, certain kind of suit, et cetera, that is pretty common now in Congress.
Well, I guess there's a uniform in all kinds of jobs
that you're
kind of expected to wear. I remember when one of our members tried to come on the floor without a tie, and Tip O'Neill, this was back in the 80s, threw him off the floor and said, we have very strict rules here that we have to wear ties. I'm not sure whether we ought to keep that rule or not in today's more casual world. But, you need rules in any organization for how people should conduct themselves. I guess I'm not so interested in the way people look or the way they dress. What I am interested in is the way we act and the way we treat one another. That's what I think is important. And frankly, the way we look is pretty much the way God made it. And, you know, the fact I don't have any eyebrows is my problem.
No, but, you know, I ask this only because image seems so important in the era of television politics and C-SPAN.
It is, but I really believe that television has really helped us. There are a lot of things about television that are probably negative and, you know, negative ads and the predominance of the 30-second spot in politics may be one of the things that's not so great. But the one good thing it's done is that it really opens up human beings to other human beings to be understood through the brutal eye of the camera. And even though you may look a certain way, people can size you up pretty quickly about who they like, who they trust, who they respect, who they think over time is a worthy person that they want to support. And with C-SPAN, they see a lot of us, probably unfortunately for some viewers, and they really can make up their mind. I often remember, and I talk about this in the book, in the 1980 campaign, I was watching the debate between Reagan and Carter with a bunch of Democratic politicians in St. Louis. And after the debate, I thought Carter really won the debate. He was much more cogent and he had better arguments. Of course, I was for him, but I was prejudiced. But at the end of the debate, I asked them who they thought won. They all said Reagan. And I said, why do you say that? How can you say that? You disagree with him on everything. You're going to vote for Carter. They said, no, but we really like him. We like him better than Carter. And I realized at that moment that television opens all of us up to one another in a very human way. It's a personal conversation. It's like meeting someone in person that we never could do before, but which really allows voters to make a human judgment about human beings.
Don't you think, though, sometimes when people look through the looks, what they're seeing instead is the charisma level? It's like in the Mark Stammity cartoon, Bob Farhad. I mean, Washington, in which he had a character, Bob Farhad, who always had charismaticians working on him.
I know.
So he did come across well.
I don't think you can overcome what the camera shows by the way you look.
Right.
I don't think you can, you know, have your physical appearance overcome other problems. Let me just be more specific. I didn't agree with Reagan on anything, much of anything. And I really didn't respect him that much because I didn't think he was that good of a president. But I must tell you that when I met him in the White House, I too liked him. He was a likable person who had many good characteristics about him. He was humorous. He seemed genuine, even though sometimes I don't think he turned out to be on some issues. But he seemed to be. He was certainly likable and respectable. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is I think television gives you a whole lot more than some kind of preconceived notion of what people should look like and begins to open up the human being as a human being, what they care about, what they think, what kind of person they are. Are they likable? Are they nice? So on and so forth.
Well, Dick Gephardt, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dick Gephardt has written a new book. It's called An Even Better Place, America in the 21st Century.